Hello, everybody. This is Adam Sharkov, your host of Film Wax Radio. You're listening to a special Fandor-sponsored episode of the podcast. This episode is includes a conversation with the filmmaker, Adam Rifkin. He's a screenwriter in Hollywood, but he also makes independent films, fortunately. And his this is his latest film. It's called Giuseppe Makes a Movie. And if you go to Fandor, the description reads, "While the rest of America slept, DIY filmmaker and musician Giuseppe Andrews, a one-time teen actor in films like Independence Day and Detroit Rock City," which Adam, by the way, directed, "Giuseppe has made over 30 experimental features with titles like Doily's Summer of Freak Occurrences, Trailer Town, and Utopia Blues, set in some demented alternate universe, i.e. Ventura, California. They are populated by real-life alcoholics and drug addicts, trash-talking senior citizens, and trailer park residents dressed in cow outfits and costume shop wigs, acting out booze-fueled vignettes of severe psychosis, filtered through Giuseppe's John Waters meets Harmony Korine meets Werner Herzog sensibility." Those are Giuseppe's movies, and check out Adam Rifkin's film. Go to Fandor.com and watch Giuseppe Makes a Movie. By the way, can get a two-week trial subscription for nothing, and then decide then if you want to subscribe to Fandor. I recommend it. Even if you see a few movies a month, you'll get your money's worth by far. And then you can go to see GiuseppeAndrews.net and see Giuseppe's movies. But Adam was a great guest. He obviously had a great time making this documentary, and I had a great time talking to Adam Rifkin on the show right now.
What they call independent film, I feel like those guys got too much money. I think to myself, boy, somebody gave that guy like $1 million or $500,000, and that's an independent film? I make films for $1,000, you know?
The whole movie will be shot in 2 days. It's probably edited that night. It's never been done before for $1,000. And we're going to make our greatest movie.
A compact little movie-making machine.
That's it. We're going to just blow through this thing like a hurricane.
He must have made 30 movies or something with the locals and the people that live in the trailer park that he lives in.
One more? Don't laugh, George. One more.
Do you work much with the actors? Do you do much rehearsing?
None. Zero. I don't even look at my script twice.
It's a fascinating way of working.
People might even call it pornographic and shit, but I don't see it like that at all. I mean, I just see it as having fun with words.
Are you nervous about it? About snorting flour?
You're not nervous about it. Snorting flour.
It can be harder to do something halfway than to actually do it. But I always regret actually doing it.
Hello.
Hey, it's nice to meet you, Adam Rifkin.
Yeah, likewise.
You're in L.A.?
Absolutely. I am in L.A.
What neighborhood?
West Hollywood.
Okay. How long have you been out there?
I've been in L.A. since I was 17.
Oh, yeah?
So you're since 84, actually, which is when I right out of high school.
Wow. Where'd you grow up, though? If you moved there after high school, where'd you grow up?
Chicago.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have any kind of nostalgic, emotional connection to that city anymore? No.
I love being from there, but I don't really, okay. I don't romanticize it any longer.
I see. Yeah.
I love being from there, and I had a great life growing up there, and for a number of years, I really missed it and romanticized it when I was out here, and
gotcha.
Then eventually, I just assimilated out here and love it out here, and this is my home, you know.
And what's the story with your becoming a filmmaker? How'd that come about?
I always loved movies. I always wanted to make movies.
Really?
From as early an age as I can remember, I was obsessed with movies. And even before I understood what a director was and what a producer was and how movies were made, I knew that I wanted to be a part of making them. I just knew that that was what I wanted to do.
What's your, like, early, one of your early memories or, you know, because that's curious. I don't hear that as often.
My earliest memories were loving monster movies. I used to watch all the old Universal monster movies that were on television a lot. In Chicago, we had a horror host
right.
named Sven Gulli.
Yeah.
He's still doing it, actually.
Is that true? Wow.
Yeah, it's true. In fact, he's on a cable channel that now is out here in L.A., so I get to watch him on Saturday nights, just like when I was a kid.
Oh.
And which is fun. So that was my first love, monster movies. And so I commandeered the family movie camera, and I just started making movies with my friends, all the while you know, plotting my big move to Los Angeles to make real movies when I got old enough. And I didn't realize it while I was doing it as a kid, but I actually turned out to be teaching myself the principles of filmmaking.
Sure.
You know, and,
sure.
And then when I got out here, I realized, oh, it's the same concept, only with more
money,
a little more money and a little more help and bigger cameras and everything, but
right.
Same principle.
It's amazing, right? Because you'd learn how you frame a shot. I mean, you just, if you're, you know, tuned in and you're doing it long enough, you
exactly.
figure it out. You, and then you figure out, oh, how not to make the same mistakes.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you were probably just innately a good storyteller. So there's that too, you know.
Well, I didn't even think about that, though. Watching as many movies as I did, it just sort of seeped into my brain, you know, sure. So.
Right. And then I'm sure it just expanded your film watching
interest. It's true. I remember the first movie that really turned my mind around that films were not just, they didn't just have to be fun, escapist, you know,
uh-huh.
cool monsters and things. I remember the first movie that sort of changed my perspective was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Right.
That was the first real character drama I saw that changed the way I thought and inspired me and moved me emotionally and made me realize, oh, movies are something you can see as an art form, and they can make people feel differently about the world, you know.
Well, Nurse Ratched was a bit of a monster.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? That movie was so rich with character actors, it's ridiculous.
It's true. It's a great movie. And it still holds up, man. It's such a great film. And so when I mean, that was the first movie. I mean, when I was a little kid, I cried at Old Yeller and I cried at Dumbo and stuff. But that was the first film that made me cry. It moved me to tears, you know. So it was an impactful experience and changed the way I saw film.
Yeah, I can imagine. Did you see it when it came out as a kid?
Yes.
Yeah, because I talk about this a lot, Adam, with people. When you know, in the late 70s, well into the 80s, there was no, I mean, there were the occasional Disney movie would come out, right? Maybe something else would come out for children, like a live action thing, like you mentioned. But there was no, like, industry. I mean, today it's just an enormous part of the movie business is children's movies. But back when you and I were kids, that didn't exist. And so we grew up kind of watching what adults watched.
It's very true. And we got a great cross-section, too, of different kinds of things. I remember growing up, television had, you know, there were just a certain number of channels, and everybody watched whatever was on those channels. So, and also, there was a lot of movies that would play on television to fill the space that they needed to fill.
Yeah.
So you would, I mean, like, I saw movies that I never otherwise would have seen in my life if they didn't just happen to be on television. Like, I remember I saw Somebody Up There Likes Me with Paul Newman once, just at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was the movie that was on,
right.
And I watched it, and I thought, man, this is a great movie, and that guy is really good, whoever he is. I mean, it was Paul Newman, of course, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not the first one to figure out that Paul Newman was great, but well, I remember I discovered he was great.
I thought you were just taking credit for discovering Paul Newman for a moment.
Yeah. I was
that might be the takeaway from our conversation.
Right. That's funny.
Yeah, so obviously the 70s.
I would say that that's my favorite period of film,
yeah.
Would be those great character dramas from the 70s.
Sure. I mean, we can get into the story of Giuseppe Andrews and this documentary, Giuseppe Makes a Movie, but I'm looking at your filmography, and you've made a lot of films in an independent spirit.
I've been very lucky in that I've been able to have a bit of a two-pronged career. I get to write studio films, and those sort of afford me the freedom,
yeah,
to get to then make, as a filmmaker, writer, director, independent films that I'm super passionate about. So, you know, and I love both.
Right.
Love all kinds of movies. I love big movies and little movies, and I love, you know, all the genres of movies. So getting to be a part of the studio system as a writer has been really fun. And the fact that it gives me the freedom to make the smaller, more personal, more experimental films has been really fulfilling.
How do you operate, like, as an independent filmmaker in L.A., where the overwhelming industry is obviously circles like the planets around the sun? And, you know, the studio system is this huge thing there that drives all the business. And there must be some community of independent filmmakers out there as well, but is that the feeling you have, or are you operating kind of on your own?
No, there's a lot of independent filmmakers, and there used to be a lot more sources of financing for independent films. It's always hard to chase and find the money to get independent films made, but right. They're out here. I mean, there's a lot of places to look, you know, and obviously there's a lot of money to make independent films from different foreign entities, but it's definitely always hard to get money to make any movie. And then the studio movies, those are, you know, they're easier to pursue because you know exactly where to pursue them. They're not easier to get,
right?
But they're easier to pursue. I mean, you've got Universal Pictures, Fox, Paramount. I mean, you've got a certain number of players, and they're the ones that make these giant studio movies, and you go to them. And by the way, if you get 7 no's, then that movie's not happening. You know what I mean? But yeah. If it's an independent movie, there's always different ways to skin that cat, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So I see you were writing, obviously you made some pretty high-profile films here as a writer. An early, an Adam Sandler, right? The Chase with...
Chase with Charlie Sheen.
Charlie Sheen.
That actually was an independent film, though. That actually, the perception of that film when it came out is that it was a studio film because it was bought by Fox and distributed by Fox, but we actually made it independently.
Oh, very good. That's true. That's right. It's during the distribution when it's picked up and acquired by a major.
Right.
I gotcha.
That was DreamWorks.
Yeah, so that's great. So you really... does this... your relationships that you have... Obviously, you fostered and you created through those projects. Does that come in handy when you're going to make an independent film? I mean,
Sometimes, yes.
I'm just wondering where that convergence occurs, you know, like, because most of the people I talk to are in Chicago or, of course, here in New York or Boston. You know, some live in L.A. and they are acting as well as writing and trying to develop stuff, and then they go somewhere and they make it somewhere else. So it's kind of a nice, unique opportunity to talk to somebody who really does have one foot in either spot.
Yeah, well, the two worlds can collide at times. And for example, I mean, you mentioned Mouse Hunt. I mean, Mouse Hunt was directed by Gore Verbinski, who's a very successful filmmaker.
Right.
In addition to directing Mouse Hunt, I mean, he directed the first 3 Pirates of the Caribbean films. He directed The Ring. He's directed lots of giant films. He directed Lone Ranger. Anyway, he is actually one of the producers of another independent film I'm making. I can't tell you what it is because we haven't announced it yet, but... I mean, there's a good example of, you know, we met on a studio project, we maintained a relationship, I wrote this independent script that I thought he might respond to, he read it, he liked it, he came on board as a producer,
right.
And it's been very helpful, you know, so.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
You get the Gore Verbinski magic.
Yeah, it's the Gore Verbinski seal of approval.
So let's talk about Giuseppe Makes a Movie, which... must be a subject of interest to you. Well, give a little bit of the backstory here. You know, he's a guy who's making movies with folks that are living in trailers, and he's making things fast and loose. And
for people who don't know, Giuseppe Makes a Movie is a documentary about Giuseppe Andrews, who's a maverick, independent, do-it-yourself filmmaker who lives in a trailer park in Ventura, California, and by the time I made my documentary about him, he had already been making his 30th feature film starring all the homeless people and derelicts and winos that live in and around the trailer park he lives in. The backstory is that I was directing a film called Detroit Rock City for New Line Cinema. And
sure.
It's a movie about 4 teenagers sneaking into a Kiss concert in 1978. And when we were casting the 4 teenage leads, the first person to come into audition for one of them was Giuseppe Andrews, who was a child actor who, at the time I met him, was probably about 19. And he came in and he was really interesting right off the bat. I mean, he just exuded something unique.
Is it just pure charisma? What was it?
He had a certain... he felt like he just stepped out of another era, which was perfect for Detroit Rock City because it was set in the 70s. He just felt like... he felt like the 70s to me for some reason. Like when I think back on growing up in the 70s, he just seemed like somebody out of that era.
Yeah.
So I cast him in the movie, and he's a great actor. And while we were shooting the film, while the other 3 kids between takes would be off, you know, smoking pot or playing video games, he would hang out on the set with me while we were setting up shots, and he would just watch us – working and want to learn filmmaking, and he just wanted to talk about movies because he was just in love with movies, and he was just taking in all the movies he could, and he was watching all the foreign films by all the masters. I mean, he was watching all the Fassbender films and all the Buñuel films and all the Ingmar Bergman films and Herzog films. And all he wanted to do was see more of them and talk more about them. And he wanted to be a director. And I was very encouraging that he should absolutely pursue that.
Essentially, he was putting himself through film school in a way.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And he said, how does he become a director? And now I assumed he wanted to make conventional style films. I had no idea what was going on in his head at the time. I said to him, you know, the good news is, and I think this applies to anybody who wants to make films, is that the technology has caught up with people's ambition. You can now make movies very inexpensively. You don't have to really wait for permission anymore. I mean, when I started, it cost, on the low end, hundreds of thousands of dollars to make a movie. You know, maybe at the very lowest, tens of thousands of dollars to make a movie. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, you can make a movie for nothing if you're clever about it. So he then, you know, went off and started making feature films with a consumer, sort of a prosumer camcorder, and all these crazy sort of homeless characters from his trailer park. And he would start coming over to my house about once a month at night and show me his latest film. And they were all feature length, and they all had, you know, beginnings, middles, and ends, and they all had A plots and B plots, and they all had, you know, they were all, you know, they all had the phantoms. They reflected the phantoms of movie structure and movie storytelling, but they were the craziest, most bizarre things I had ever seen in my entire life. I mean, they were just wacko. And they were also the funniest things I had ever seen. I mean, every one of them made me laugh harder than I had ever laughed before. And he would tell me these stories about what it would take to wrangle these people that he was working with. And he would also tell me about, you know, his affection for them all and how he was really kind of, he had really kind of created this family of misfits, and that they all were so, that these films were so meaningful to them because they felt like they were being, A, taken seriously for the first time in a long time. I mean, they were being treated with respect and their dignity.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And also they were feeling creative, and that they were, their creativity was being valued. And so I said to him, you know, I really would love to make a documentary about the process of you making one of these films. My feeling was that it wasn't going to last forever. This bubble he had kind of created was going to be somewhat short-lived. So I said, let me document one of these films. Now, he's notoriously shy about interviews. He's very socially kind of standoffish. He didn't ever want to do interviews when he was an actor. But he felt really comfortable with me. And so he said, yes, you can make a documentary about me making one of these movies. So he said, I'm about to shoot my next one this weekend. Why don't you come up and shoot
this weekend?
Yeah, exactly. So I borrowed a camera and I drove up to Ventura, just me, and I documented the whole soup to nuts process from the time I showed up to the time I left. It took about a weekend of him making this insane film called Garbanzo Gas. And yeah, I think it really captured what goes on up there, and it's pretty nuts.
But what's universal about it that you felt people would connect to, not knowing Giuseppe's movies?
What I felt made it universal was the family unit that he created. I found that very touching. All of these people were misfits. They were outcasts. They were outsiders, as was Giuseppe. He felt very much like an outsider. Giuseppe grew up, he and his father grew up in a van. He himself for years was homeless. And so he sort of became, they were his muses, and he was their sort of touchstone to something meaningful. And I found that, I mean, regardless of the fact that whether he was making a movie or whether they were building a barn or whatever the project was, the fact that he brought these people together and made them feel special, I found that to be touching, and ultimately, I think that's what makes it universal.
And the course of Giuseppe Makes a Movie, you get loose sense of time almost, you know, just watching it. It's so fascinating, but you can't be sure, is this happening over a week or two? You know, it's just shocking that it was such a short period of time, because by the end of it, you really do feel like you've gotten to know these people with all their eccentricities and complexities, and you're rooting for them, and you never really even get a chance, because of the pace of the film, to feel too sorry for any of them either. And I think that comes from what you described before as that he had a respect for these guys, and it very much translates as we watch your documentary.
Thank you.
So I didn't feel so sorry for the drug addict or the alcoholic, you know, that I normally might, because you don't give us that opportunity to do that. That's not what the movie's about.
That is exactly right. That is not what the movie's about. I did not want to make a movie about the plight of the homeless crisis in America. You know, there are better documentaries and better documentarians who should capture that story.
Yeah.
I wanted to make a movie about these people making this film and feeling creative and feeling a part of something special. And that to me is what the movie's about. And I didn't want to wallow in, you know, how depressing it is to be homeless. I wanted to tell their stories, and I wanted to get to know them. And some of their stories are a little bit checkered, and of course that's going to be the case. But the movie is about the process that these people go through to create something, to create art. They're all creating art together.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, and by the way, it could have easily been a documentary about homeless kids painting a mural. You know what I mean? This one just happened to be these homeless people and these trailer park residents making this movie.
Yeah. And also this movie says, this is also what storytelling looks like. You know, it's not just all the other typical things we see. This can all, you know, this guy's making a legitimate film, an expression of storytelling.
Oh, his movies are real movies. I mean,
right.
They're crazy.
Sure.
I get it. But yeah, I mean, people, you know, he's got a very loyal fan base, and they really dig his films, and his films tell stories, you know?
So where do people see those movies? How do they see Giuseppe's movies?
Movies are all available on his website, which is giuseppeandrews.net.
Gotcha, okay. So he'll come to you. No, he sounds a little shy, so maybe he won't actually deliver them himself, but he'll...
No, but you can get them online, watch them online.
Oh, you can. Okay. All right, yeah. So does he have a paywall, as they say?
Yes, he does. Right. And his wife runs his website, and you can see them all on his website.
All right, now for the big question, Adam.
Yes, sir.
When you showed Giuseppe the movie, what was his response? And were you nervous?
I was nervous because I wanted him to like it. When I made the movie, I felt as though I was being as truthful and respectful as I could be.
Sure.
And I hoped that the reflection of the honesty and what I captured and what I saw, he would see, you know, for what it was. And then as soon as we sent it to him, I started to think, well, I hope he doesn't misinterpret this or that. Anyway, turns out he said it was the greatest documentary ever made.
You said, I agree with you.
Yeah, well, Mike Plant, the producer, and I debated briefly using that quote on the poster. But then we thought, well, the subject of a documentary saying it's the greatest documentary ever made, as the quote on the poster, might seem odd. So we chose not to. But he loves the documentary.
Yeah, no, that's great news. And what about the rest of the cast members of Garbanzo Gas?
Well, they've never seen the documentary. Here's the thing. Okay. They are genuine homeless people.
Right.
So the time the movie got finished, which was a number of years after we actually initially shot it.
Okay.
They have all, for the most part, wandered off into different directions.
It's part of the...
of the world. Many of them whereabouts unknown.
Yeah.
So none of them have seen it. And I hope if any of them ever come across it, they'll appreciate it, but who knows if they'll ever see it, you know?
I understand. Yeah, I guess that's part of the deal, you know, this transient lifestyle. Yeah, you know, that's part of the
journey. And when the film was screening at the Los Angeles Film Festival, I reached out to, I tried to find all of them. or as many of them as I could. And the only one of the whole group, many of them, like I said, whereabouts unknown, a few of them I found out had died. And then there was one that I found, who's one of the main ones, who was still homeless, but had a job at that time working as a, there's an antique stove restoration shop in Ventura. And he found a job there cleaning vintage stove parts, scraping off,
ash,
you know, whatever.
Yeah, residue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I called that shop, and they put him on the phone. He was in the back scraping away. He wasn't even wearing a mask. He's just, you know. And I said, hey, Dongo, it's Adam Rifkin. I made the documentary about you and Giuseppe. He remembered me. Oh, yeah, man, how are you? And I said, listen, the movie is going to be premiering at the Los Angeles Film Festival, and I'd love for you to come down and be a part of it and see it. And he said, oh, no, I'm not going to do that. I said, why not? People would love to see you. People would love to hear what you have to say. I'd love for you to see the film. He's like, oh, no way, man. I'm not interested. You know, we surmised he might have warrants out, and he didn't want to be anywhere that was, you know, too public.
Right.
But he just had no interest in seeing the documentary at all.
Wow. Yeah. It's impossible to put yourself in their shoes, because you just have to know that there are other ways people live.
It's true.
Respect
it. And that's actually, yeah, it's true. We have to respect it. And that's one of the things that I find so great about Giuseppe is, and you see it in the documentary, is he is so respectful of their various eccentricities, and he just accepts them for who they are. You know, many of these people that you see, I mean, if you saw them coming towards you on the street, you would walk to the other side of the street. But Giuseppe embraced them with open arms without any irony. I mean, he just accepted them like family members.
Right.
And they clearly, you can tell, appreciated it, and he got so much from them, and they got so much from him, and that's all part of why I felt the experience was touching, and that's, you know, I think that's in the film. I think that's reflected in the film.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much, and Giuseppe Makes a Movie, directed by Adam Rifkin and produced by Mike Plant, our friend Mike Plant, is available on Fandor now.
Yes, please check it out.
Yeah, I would recommend that with no hesitation whatsoever. It's
thank
thoroughly enjoyable, entertaining, moving at time. And yeah, so it's terrific to meet you, and promise that the next opportunity comes about, we can do this again. Let me know.
I would love it. Yeah.
Okie doke.
Cool, man. Well, thank you so much.
Sure, thank you.
While you're on Fandor, checking out Giuseppe Makes a Movie, one of their other focuses this month on the work of Orson Welles, in celebration of Orson Welles' 100th birthday this week, they had this incredible project that I never even heard of until I saw it here, which was a television project that Orson Welles was involved with, a travel show that he did in 1955. And I think there were like a half a dozen episodes where he travels around Europe doing these different episodes. And they're all, I guess, together in this one now work called Around the World from 1955. So you can see that. And then if you're there and you're exploring Orson Welles and you haven't seen The Trial, his film from 1963, which is an adaptation of the Franz Kafka story, and it stars Anthony Perkins as Joseph K. And then also you can see The Stranger, his classic, where with Edward G. Robinson, who stars as a government agent tracking down a high-ranking Nazi officer in a small suburban town. So they're all such great films. Check those out on Fandor. And, of course, many, many, many more titles. They must have thousands of titles at this point, including, by the way, shorts and mid-length films, not only just feature-length films, and of every variety, from sexploitation to dramas and science fiction. And, I mean, you name it, it's all there on Fandor. So do check it out. Thank you to that great, great film streaming organization for sponsoring so many of my episodes. I appreciate it, and I'm 100% behind this great organization. Thank you for listening to this episode of Film Wax Radio. We'll be back next time soon. Thank you.
I'm under arrest.
Yeah?
Unbelievable, isn't it?
Well, it happens.
Well, that's just the point. I don't know how it happens. I haven't the remotest idea.
How do you know you're arrested? It isn't something you just suddenly notice, like bleeding gums.
They woke me up and told me.
Are you sure you were awake?
No, with your arrest, I get the feeling of something abstract, if you see what I mean.
I see it so abstract, I can't even consider that it applies to me.
Accused men are attractive.
I don't pretend to be a martyr, no.
Not even a victim of society.
I am a member of society.
That behind my arrest, a vast organization is at work. An establishment which contains a retinue of civil servants, officers, police, and others. Perhaps even hangmen. You! You'll have to kill me! Come on! Come on!
This case is hopeless.
What the hell?